David Brooks describes two kinds of virtues. There are resume virtues and there are eulogy virtues. And he says, resume virtues are the skills you bring to the marketplace. Eulogy virtues are the ones that are talked about at your funeral. Right? Whether you were kind, brave, honest, or faithful, were you capable of deep love? And at the church where Morgan and I attend, I've been preaching through Proverbs. And I talk a lot about wisdom as the skill of living. And though I use that word skill, even though we identify wisdom as a skill, it's really much more a eulogy virtue than a resume virtue. Right? Wisdom is about the long-term character of your life, the qualities that outlive you and get passed on to the next generation, to those who follow in your footsteps. What difference will your life make? That's what wisdom is about. What difference does your life make? And I know that sometimes in the busyness of life, you know, when you've got deadlines to meet and you've got screaming kids and all of those things going on, that when you're just trying to survive another day, that question could be the farthest thing from your mind. And yet as I grow older, I think more and more about what kind of impact will my life have on those who follow after me? What kind of difference will I make to my children, to my grandchildren, to others in my sphere of influence? That's the emphasis of Proverbs 16, verses 31 to 17, verse 6. The passage begins and ends by talking about crowns and age. It says gray hair is a crown of glory in Proverbs 16, verse 31, verse 6, or of chapter 17. It says grandchildren are the crown of the aged. So this reference to gray hair, this reference to the aged, speaks to the longevity of wisdom, but there's also this emphasis on family. And so in this message, we're going to see how those two are related, and we're going to talk about three things. Number one, the fact that wisdom encompasses a lifetime. It's not just for the short dash, but it's for a marathon of life. And then number two, wisdom involves waiting on the Lord. That this is what it takes to be wise for a lifetime. That in order to be wise for a lifetime, you need to wait on the Lord. And we're going to talk especially about ruling your own spirit. And then number three, wisdom leaves a legacy that impacts future generations. So number one, wisdom encompasses a lifetime. Proverbs 16, verse 31, gray hair is a crown of glory. It is gained in a righteous life. Gray hair is not always appreciated, right? We don't like going gray because it means that we're getting older. And you've heard people say, my wife said it a few weeks ago, it isn't fun getting old. There are a lot of challenges that come with aging. And on top of that, society sometimes has negative attitudes. It has negative stereotypes about older adults. We may be viewed as outdated, incompetent, and irrelevant. And notice I said we, right? I'm getting old. I'm getting a few grays. People are beginning to notice. So it may sound strange to our ears to hear that gray hair is like a glorious crown resting on one's head. But it's not just about getting old that is the crown of glory. It says here that this crown comes from walking in the way of righteousness. In other words, gray hair is magnificent. It is beautiful and it is honorable when it is a symbol of wisdom learned over the years. Sadly, not all old people are wise. In order for gray hair to be a crown, it says here we have to live a righteous life. And now, let me be clear that our righteousness doesn't make us right with God, right? you're sitting under Bruce's teaching, and you know that. You've heard that over and over again. Righteousness, our righteousness doesn't make us right with God. We become right with God by faith in Jesus Christ, who is the only perfectly righteous one, right? And so we put our faith in him. But when we put our faith in him, we are united with him. And his life is lived out through us, in us. And so we can live this righteous life by the power of his Spirit. What does that look like? What does a righteous life look like? Well, in the words of Bruce Waltke, and I think he has this great definition of righteousness, right? Being righteous means that you are willing to disadvantage yourself for the advantage of others. The righteous disadvantage themselves for the advantage of others. That's what a righteous life is. It is the path of biblical love. It's not just a feel-good type of love. It is not culturally acceptable expressions of love. It is the kind of love that God shows to us. It is love defined and shaped by God and his truth. It is not self-centered. It is God-centered, and it is others-oriented. And it includes love for our enemies. So this morning, I'm reading a little bit, and I come across this thing about love and loving our enemies. It says, Jesus says that when we see others as they are, in all of their ugliness and spitefulness, all of their cursing, all of their hatred, all of their unwillingness to pay us what they owe us, Jesus says we are to be realistic about all of it and then love them. And then love them. Seeing all of that enmity, all that hatred, says Jesus, I want you to love your enemies. By nature, we are incapable of displaying such love, but consider the kind of difference we would make to our culture if we were prepared to live out in both everyday and extraordinary ways a Christ-like love which seeks to do what's best for those who have acted in hatred towards us. That would be revolutionary. That would be revolutionary. That's what we're called to. A lifetime of loving like that. Of walking in righteousness. To do that consistently. That's just not in me. Not in my own strength. When you are united with Christ and you trust him and you walk in his path and you depend on him, he will give you the power to do that. And if you do that for a lifetime, the longer you walk on that path, the more splendid your crown of gray will be. So grow and mature in the way of righteousness. Pursue wisdom. Pursue righteousness. Not just for a season of life, but for all the years that God has remaining for you. Whether it's another day or another decade or longer, pursue the wisdom, the righteousness that God calls us to. Have a long view of wisdom. It is good to grow old walking in the way of righteousness. That call is lifelong. So it encompasses a lifetime. Secondly, wisdom waits on the Lord. And again, we're talking about the long view, right? Wisdom requires patience. And when I say wait on the Lord, I don't mean let go and let God. When I say wait on the Lord, I don't mean be passive and wait for God to do everything. When I say wait on the Lord, I don't mean be fatalistic. You know, whatever will be, will be. That's not what we're talking about when we talk about waiting on the Lord. What did we just say? You know, it's a righteous walk. It's a righteous life. It requires us to love even our enemies. That takes effort. It takes sacrifice. You can't be passive doing any of that. But sometimes in our desire to reach a destination, what do? We take a shortcut, right? Oh, I know a quicker way there. And men, you know what I'm talking about if you drive, right? I know a quicker way there. And your wife says, no. Take the way we know. No, I know a quicker way. And sure enough, right? It takes a little bit longer. And she's so gracious. She doesn't say, I told you so. Sometimes we do that with God. We deviate from the path because it's too long or too hard. To wait on the Lord requires us to actively pursue wisdom and to do so in faith, trusting God even when the way seems tiresome or impossible, and especially when we're frustrated. It means we stay on the path of wisdom for the long run rather than turn aside to our own way. And I want to show you that from verses 32 and 33. In verse 32, Solomon stresses the importance of patience. He says, whoever is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who rules his spirit than he who takes a city. To be slow to anger means you're not a hothead. You don't overreact. You don't rashly take matters into your own hands. And in the Bible, this is often used in the context of being wronged. And so when someone sins against you, when someone offends you, when someone hurts you, the patient person doesn't rush to vengeance, doesn't rush to get even. As much as they want to get even, they don't rush to that. And you know, we can apply this to many, many areas of life where our anger causes us to run ahead of God's way, to get what we want by our own human wisdom. And as the second part of the verse puts it, the problem is, our problem is we don't exercise self-control and rule our own spirit. Mark Horn explains why this is such a challenge for us. He says, you know what you need to do and should do, and in some sense, you want to do it, but your various urges and short-term desires sabotage your plans because you don't rule yourself. Compulsive behaviors or bad habits overwhelm your plans to reach your goals. We know what we want to do. We know what we should do. But the stuff within inside of us rises up and takes over. And we don't rule our spirit. And so rather than ruling ourselves, you know, we would rather rule and control our circumstances. We would rather rule and control the people around us than control our own spirit. And Solomon likens it to a mighty warrior who has the strength and skill to capture a city, who is someone who is able to get things done. And we all want to be like that. We all see the mighty person, the warrior, and we say, we want to be like that person. The one who, when our path is blocked and our frustration boils over, we can do what it takes to get what we want. That's who we want to be, the mighty one. But in contrast to that outward might, we're told that there's something better. Real strength is being able to govern yourself and harness your passions. That's real strength. Why is it important to rule your spirit? To be patient, to be slow to anger. Why is that so important? It's because our self-rule is connected to God's rule of our lives. And that out-of-control anger turns us from God's path. You see, this proverb is not just about self-discipline. There are all kinds of people with self-discipline, right? Who have physical and emotional and even religious self-discipline. You can find them all over the place. But as verse 33 draws out, the reason we're to control our spirit is so that we will steadfastly rely on the Lord and wait on him. The verse says, the lot is cast into the lap, and its every decision is from the Lord. The usual interpretation of that verse is that God is in control of all things, including chance and unknown things, right? Chance occurrences. And so the casting of the lot is often compared to the rolling of the dice, right? So you go to the tables and you throw the dice and it comes up sixes or whatever, and that even God controls is how that verse is typically interpreted. So what is random or coincidence to us is not to God. He's in control of everything. He decides everything that happens. And since that's true and he is in control of everything, we don't have to be uncontrollably angry about bad things that happen. We can persevere in doing what is right and trust God with the outcome. Normal, typical, maybe even almost everybody's type of interpretation. There is another way, however, to understand this verse that a few have brought out, it is this idea that in the ancient world, the casting of lot was not just something you did as a game. The casting of lots was what you did to determine the will of the gods. And so you remember the story of Jonah, right? And they're in this boat, and there's this huge storm going on, and the sailors, all these Gentile sailors, say, who's responsible for this? How did this happen? What do? They go around and say, hey, are you responsible for this? Are you responsible? What do? They cast lots, right? They throw whatever it is to determine who is responsible for this calamity. So the Gentiles did it. The Jews did it as well. Israel cast lots to figure out who should be the next person to go into the temple area. Where should they lot the land? They cast lots. So the casting of lots was a way to find out the will of God. And if that's the emphasis here in verse 33, then it's not talking about any random event. It's talking about a person seeking God's will. And it's saying that the answer ultimately comes from God. His decisions, his judgments will eventually come to pass. But the thing is, he unfolds his will step by step. Right? You've seen that in your life. God, what's next? And you want to see the whole big picture, the whole plan for your life, right? And what does he show you? This little bit. And you say, that's not enough. I need to know more, God. What do you mean? That's it? But that's how God works. He doesn't show us everything. He gives us just this tiny little bit for the next step, and we want more. And so we have to practice patience and rule our spirit. We don't let anger rule us, trusting that God will answer in his way, in his time. And so instead of various urges and short-term desires and compulsive behaviors and bad habits ruling our lives, we are to persevere in seeking God's will and doing what pleases him. And in the New Testament, this is described as keeping in step with the Spirit as we walk by the Spirit. Keep in step with him. Don't run ahead of him. Don't lag behind him. Keep in step with him as you walk by the Spirit, and he may not go at the pace you want him to go, but keep in step with the Spirit. And do that, and do that, and do that, and that is what it takes to walk righteously, to live righteously for a lifetime. That's what it takes. You got to rule your spirit. When you rule your spirit in the way of righteousness all along into old age, your gray hair will be a crown atop your head. And that brings us to number 3, wisdom leaves a legacy. Wisdom leaves a legacy. Proverbs 17, verses 1 to 6, I take as an application of verses 31 through 33, and it applies it to the family. Wisdom and old age are now placed within the context of the home, and we are again encouraged to think long term because the passage addresses generational issues. And to help us to grasp the importance of this, verses 1 to 5 serve as a warning. They describe someone who doesn't practice righteousness and patience, and the impact of this is seen on the home in verse 1. Better is a dry morsel with quiet than a house full of feasting with strife. So we're to picture this big get-together. The whole family has been invited over, and everyone is sitting down together for a meal. Maybe even friends have gathered for this big meal. And of course, you want laughter and you want conversation, because quiet here doesn't mean no sound. You want that laughter. You want that conversation. You want noise when everyone is together. What you don't want is strife. What you don't want is underlying tensions, open animosity, bitter disagreements, festering anger. You don't want those things. We will have conflicts in our relationships, all right? And we will have conflicts with the people who are closest to us. That's a given of life. It's how we deal with it that matters, right? We need to honestly confront those conflicts. We need to practice genuine forgiveness. But strife is war. Strife is bitter war. And a home where there is peace is better than a war-filled home, even if all you have is a dry, crusty morsel of bread. You invite your whole family over for a meal, and all you put in front of them is this day-old piece of bread. And that's better if you have peace, shalom, than if you have the biggest feast and your house, your home is filled with war, with strife. What makes this image even more startling is that the feast is a sacrifice meal. It may have been the peace offering, which was an offering you brought when God had blessed you and you wanted to say, thank you, God, for your goodness, for all the blessings you've brought into our family and into our life. And you give this offering, and part of it gets burnt up, and part of it gets given back to you so that you can then go home, take that part that's been given back to you, prepare this big feast, have all your family and friends over to rejoice that God has been so good to you. And that's the imagery that's used here. And instead of this sacrifice of peace, there is this sacrifice of strife. A feast of strife. And the peace offering has become war. So who's the cause of this strife? Well, in a family, right, it could be anyone, right? It could be parent, it could be children, it could be siblings, it could be in-laws, it could be anyone. But in this particular passage, it's applied to a son. It talks about a son who brings strife to the family. If we read verses 1 and 2 together, what we have is a foolish son. And so the verse says, verse 2 says, a servant who deals wisely will rule over a son who acts shamefully and will share the inheritance as one of the brothers. And that word rule points us back to chapter 16, verse 32. Where it was used of ruling one's spirit. And I think the connection here is deliberate. to indicate that the son has brought shame on the family because he has not ruled his own spirit. And by not ruling his own spirit, someone else will rule his family. The son brings disgrace on the family because he allows his impulses to run free. He's not slow to anger. His absence of patience boils over in strife. And this verse is saying one day his lack of self-control will lead to ruin, and shamefully someone outside of the family will take over the household, the estate. That mention of the wise servant who becomes the inheritor is meant to be shocking. Because in ancient law, there was no provision for a servant to become the inheritor of the home. There was just no provision for that. And so it was meant to be shocking. How could this possibly be? But this is how valuable wisdom is. Even a servant, if he is prudent and wise, if he has godly insight and makes reasoned decisions, if he rules his spirit, has hope of inheritance, while a shameful son will lose everything. And verse 3 reminds us here that, you know, again, this is a matter of the heart, that we are dealing with our spirit, with the internal control of our life. All right, verse 3, the crucible is for silver, the furnace is for gold, and the Lord tests hearts. We look at the external. We look at the mighty warrior, right? And that's where our focus is. But God looks to the internal. Do we trust him? Do we wait on him? Do we rule our spirit? Just as you put ore through the fire to see what kind of silver, what kind of gold content there is, God strips away all the external pretensions of our life. And he looks at our heart. He goes to the inside. And he sees what's there. He exposes the character of our hearts. He gets at the reality of who we are. You know, we can hide our hearts from others. We can even hide it from ourselves. But the Lord examines us from the inside out. And as the next two verses show, the test exposes whether or not we are ruling our spirit. Verses 4 and 5 talk about two kinds of malevolent people whose internal impulses control and eventually sabotage their life. And I take these as two areas of battle within our heart, within our spirit. The first is a lying or deceptive heart. An evildoer listens to wicked lips, and a liar gives ear to a mischievous tongue. Now, the parallel lines identify the evildoer as a liar. They're the same person. And the intent is to show the character of the one who listens to wickedness. What's their character? They're a liar. Within their heart, within who they are, they lie. What is he like on the inside? He has a lying heart. That's a really powerful insight here, right? Why would we even listen to something that's wicked? Why would we even listen to evil words? It's because we have a deceptive heart that we need to rule over. And if we don't, we will bring ruin. The translation here says mischief. We will bring mischief on ourselves. The second kind of heart, the second area of battle, is a mocking heart. Verse 5, whoever mocks the poor insults his maker. He who is glad at calamity will not go unpunished. To mock someone is to treat them with contempt. It's to ridicule them. To be glad at calamity is to gloat over someone else's misfortune. It's to rejoice at someone else's pain and suffering. And again, it's this internal heart issue. Right? Mocking the poor comes from a heart that feels superior to those who are going through hard times. But this kind of mocking, Solomon says, is really an attack on God. He's the maker and the sovereign of our lives. And so there's pride here, thinking that we're better than others. And even this mocking of how God has worked in this person's life. And if we don't rule our spirit in this area, God will bring judgment on us. And this is such a battle. Even driving here this morning, I see something, and my first instinct, the first instinct of my heart, is to mock. And the second instinct is to deceive myself and to say, hey, it's not that bad, or they deserved it. And so what Solomon paints for us here is this picture of a son who doesn't rule his spirit. And in these two areas of battle, he doesn't rule his spirit. And there are so many other areas of battle. He doesn't rule his spirit. He does not live a righteous life as a result. And he brings angry strife to the home and shameful ruin on the family. His heart is far from God. It's filled with lying and with mocking. And I think Solomon gives us this portrait so that as we read this and we come to the end of it, we say, I don't want to leave that kind of legacy. I don't want the people who come after me to be like that. And it prepares us for verse 6, where we find the portrait of a godly family. Grandchildren are the crown of the aged, and the glory of children is their fathers. Notice the repetition of crown and old age from Proverbs 16, verse 31. Just as gray hair is a crown to the aged, so grandchildren are a crown to grandparents. Grandchildren are a crown to grandparents. Ask me if my grandchildren make me beam. Want to see some pictures? Most grandparents have great pride in their grandchildren, great joy in them. But the verse is not talking about the natural affection of grandparents for their grandchildren. It's not talking about that natural affection. And the reason I say that is because of how the second part of the verse is worded. There's a bit of a twist here. Instead of saying children are the pride of their parents, which is natural, right? That's a natural thing to say. You as a parent, you're proud of your son or your daughter. That's not what it says. It says the opposite. The pride flows the other way. The glory flows the other way. Children glory in their parents. Fathers are the glory of their children. And that word glory is also repeated from Proverbs 16, verse 31. And so the repetition of both crown and glory is meant to show us that what we have here are three generations of people walking in righteousness. There is a legacy of faithful wisdom passed from father to son to grandson. And by saying that parents are the glory of their children, it stresses that the children see great beauty, they see great honor in the wisdom of their parents, and they in turn have passed that wisdom on to their children, which is why the grandchildren are the crown of their grandparents. And this is the spiritual legacy we want to leave for those who come after us. We don't want just our children and grandchildren to have a good life, to get a good job, find a good spouse. We want them to live a righteous life, ruling their own spirit and waiting on the Lord. As I grow older, I want, by faith, to live as wisely as possible. To live a righteous life. I also want to pass on wisdom to my children, to my grandchildren, especially now, because they're in the formative years. more than a material inheritance, I want to give them a spiritual inheritance. And so when Solomon talks here about a lifetime of wisdom, and he talks here about waiting on the Lord, and he talks here about leaving a legacy, that strikes a chord with my heart. It strikes a chord with me. And yet when I look at Solomon, I see failure in this area. His son was foolish from almost the start of his reign, and his legacy, Solomon's son's legacy, was he did evil because he had not set his heart on seeking the Lord. And in fact, the Bible is filled with king after king after king who did not pass on wisdom. And it's a sad, it's a discouraging record, but it is a reality. Just because you are a person of great faith does not mean your children will have great faith. There is no certainty, but we are called to be faithful. That's our job. Our job is to rule our spirit. Our job is to faithfully show the beauty of Christ and his wisdom in a righteous life. That's what we're called to do. I want to end with a little bit of a turn. Just a little bit more here, just a bit of a reminder that we are ultimately called to center our hearts on the legacy of Jesus Christ, not our own legacy. Solomon's greater son is where we need to focus our lives, lest our children or our grandchildren become idols to us. We need to remember that Jesus alone is the one through whom we have an inheritance in God's family. And his legacy will not fail. And one day, if we are part of that legacy by faith, and the impact that we have is not just with physical children, but with spiritual children, one day, if we are faithful, we will receive a crown that is far better than a crown of gray hair or a crown of grandchildren. We will receive a crown from Jesus himself. Blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial, for when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life, which God has promised to those who love him. And henceforth, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day, and not only to me, but also to all who have loved his appearing. Let's pray together.